Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for over 30 years, and if you've listened to this program before, and it's been once a month for about 2 or 3 years now, you know he knows his stuff. Get in line early. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also comment or throw a question our way via email, voxpop@wamc.org. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. We have a Vox Pop wall post there. You can also post below today's show page on our website. I know this is a bit confusing, but if you go to wamc.org/voxpop, there's a spot to comment there, and you can find out all the ways that I just told you that you've probably forgotten by now. But the one to remember is the phone number, 1-800-348-2551. Gordon, the preamble gets longer and longer every show.
Boy, it does. It's all these different means of getting through to us nowadays.
Yeah, and you know, people actually will get some good email questions or web questions. So let's go right to the phones and Nick in Great Barrington. Nick.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Gordon. How are you?
Good.
I have a question about fuel additives that claim to break up carbon inside the combustion chamber on the valves. I don't know if I should name any brands, but in general, what do you think of these things? Do they work?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very common subject lately. Fuel quality there was some issues with fuel quality, and we spoke about it on the last show. When carburetors died off and fuel injection systems came in, the gasoline wasn't ready for it, and a lot of deposits started building up in areas that they never did before, intake valves around the injector itself. And the fuel companies were a little slow to blend more detergents and cleaners in the gas. So in the 80s, I worked at a large import dealership. We sold Volkswagens, Porsches, and Audis, and these cars were all fuel injected, and they were suffering.
Even then?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Volkswagen, believe it or not, had fuel injection on a production car in 1968, and it was electronic.
Wow.
So in any case, we were involved in additives right off the bat, and the chemical or the combination of compounds that was put into this was called Tecron, and was made by the Chevron Corporation. And to answer your question, yes, there's cheap ones out there, and there's things you can pour in the gas tank that probably doesn't do any good or very little. But there's also a very good additives that are advisable to put in periodically.
Some of them, I've heard that you actually put into the intake manifold instead of into the fuel tank.
Yeah, well, there are some that if you've got a serious carbon buildup, you can put them through the intake, through a vacuum line, or in the earlier days where you had what was called throttle body fuel injection, you could actually pour it into the intake while the engine was running. And that would definitely break up the carbon and soften it, and then it would burn up out the tailpipe. So, yes, you're right in that case.
So does the increased carbon deposits, does that result in a little bit more pinging and knocking?
Well, it can. If they build up and make the combustion chamber smaller, you, in effect, have raised your compression. So you definitely could get pinging and pre-ignition from that.
So compression, in other words, a higher compression would require a higher octane? Is that how that works?
Exactly, yes. The higher the compression, the higher the octane of the gas needs to be to prevent that pre-ignition or detonation.
Hmm. Great question, Nick. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Appreciate it. And we know we've talked about Tecron, and I think Lucas Oil makes one, and there are several out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, and they're very good. You just have to weed through them. And what I always say is you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
The really, really cheap ones that say they do everything probably don't.
Okay.
You know?
Fair enough. Let's go to Ken in Catskill. Ken, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a 2006 Hyundai Elantra GT. It's a 5.5-speed. And a couple of weeks ago, the cruise control started working only intermittently, and sometimes it would stay on for a while, and sometimes it wouldn't. Sometimes I couldn't get it to go on at all, and now it's quit completely. And I'm trying to figure out whether that's something I could troubleshoot myself, or do I need to go into a shop or the dealer?
Yeah. In the early days, cruise control systems were a pure add-on. So you had your, going back to the carburetor days, you had your carburetor, your linkage from your gas pedal, and the cruise was totally in addition to all that stuff. So there was another cable or a rod, there was vacuum lines, there was a ton of stuff that could go wrong. Today, cruise control is totally integrated in the software and of the engine management system. So there's not a lot you can do. And I don't, what year is your car again, Ken?
2006.
Yeah, I'm not sure how Hyundai configured the cruise on that vehicle. But most cars today are, there's no throttle cable or linkage. It's throttle by wire. So the system is completely electronic.
Is this something that maybe just a software reinstall could fix?
In any case, it probably needs to get scanned to see if there's any cruise trouble codes or information. The brake light switch in the early days was always could be trouble because when you step on the brake pedal, the cruise needs to immediately be turned off for obvious reasons.
Right.
And in the early days, we had a lot of brake light switches, and sometimes the cruise had their own switch. So it wasn't the brake light switch failing, it was the cruise turn-off switch. So you could look under there and see if there's what's going on.
You say look under where?
Where your brake pedal is located. If you can get your head under there and see where the switch is, have somebody take a look at your brake lights and see if they're coming on super early. In other words, the second you breathe on the brake pedal, if your taillights are on, your brake light switch may be way too high, adjusted too sensitive, and maybe it's turning the cruise off intermittently on you.
Well, now it doesn't come on at all.
Oh, so now you're not working at all?
Yeah. Not at all.
Yeah, I don't think there's much other that you can do other than that. Is see if make sure that brake light switch is in the right spot, which it probably is, and then it's just going to have to be diagnosed.
And that's a dealer or any shop?
If the shop has software to scan in there, I would ask them first if they're if they've got cruise control experience or if they have the software for that vehicle. Other than that, yes, it would be a dealer item.
Yeah. Sound like something that's expensive?
I don't know. Like Ray was saying, once in a while, a lot of these things are reprogramming issues, software changes, and you're not going to know if that's the case until you take it in somewhere, and then they suggest that maybe that could be it.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. So Gordon Fricke, by the way, is our guest. Take us back to the history of the cruise control. While Ken was on the phone, I was trying to remember the first time we had it in a family vehicle. I want to say 70s. When did they start?
Believe it or not, it was on 60s cars.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty big option because it was quite a contraption to, in the 60s, Cadillacs had it.
Yeah.
Higher end Buicks and Oldsmobiles and other U.S. made cars, some big Chryslers, I'm sure, had it. And it was a total add-on system. It had and it was vacuum operated. They did everything by vacuum in those days because electronics hadn't advanced enough to do things like that with. So you had a big vacuum diaphragm that would, at the direction of the cruise control, pull the throttle, and it would give the car more or less gas. It was a device that measured the speed of the car. It was tied into the speedometer, and I think they were probably pretty crude as far as how sensitive they were to going above and below the speed and turning on and off. I think they were probably clunky, but I've seen that as looking in old car guides and stuff that was an option in the 60s, maybe even the 50s. I don't know.
So only on cars with automatic transmissions?
Well, I don't know because I have a lot of, when I worked at the dealership, we did a lot of European cars, and there was cruise control systems on manual shift cars.
Oh, really?
Yes, and every time you shifted, the cruise turned off because you depressed the clutch pedal, and when you put it in the next gear, I think it had the ability to resume because it knew you were clutching and declutching.
Wow.
When you stepped on the brake pedal, that's when it totally shut the system off.
I would think it would only really be worth it if you were in overdrive on a highway.
Yeah, it's weird because it's funny you mentioned that because I remember test driving 5-speed cars with cruise.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Yes, we'll take a pause in our reminiscing about the wonders of cruise control and take a break here. Gordon Fricke's our guest. Your automotive questions answered coming up.
Support comes from Ashokan Center Olive Bridge, presenting Uke Fest, a 4-day music camp May 23rd to the 26th with the All-Star Ukulele Concert on Saturday, May 25th. AshokanCenter.org. Careers in Transition LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, resume, and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community. Berkshire.coop. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. Nature.org/Adirondacks. And Downtown Schenectady Improvement Corporation, announcing the 2014 Merchant Mashup. Restaurants and shops unite and sample potato recipes during the Spud Challenge, tonight 5 to 8. DowntownSchenectady.com for information.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and we take your automotive questions. Barbara in Brooklyn? Barbara, are you really in Brooklyn?
Well, not at the moment, but I'm from Brooklyn. Okay. I'm listening to you in the car.
Fair enough. Well, you're on.
Great. Okay, I have two questions. The first one is, how many miles between oil changes, and what happens if you don't change within that?
The perennial question, and a good one.
Yeah, very good question, because it seems like as every week passes, we encounter or hear about more oil-related problems. What kind of car do you have? That'll help.
I have a 2006 Golf, CW Golf.
Okay. The maintenance manual in that car might tell you that it's 10,000 miles between oil changes. Under perfect conditions, and it maybe it's less than that, but my advice in most cases is to cut those intervals in half. We don't live in a perfect climate that's considered normal service. We have season changes, we have dusty conditions, we have hot and cold, and you know,
stop and go too, right?
Yes.
If Barbara's from Brooklyn,
exactly.
There's some stop and go involved.
Absolutely, yeah. Idling is terrible on oil. If you idle your car like a taxi, idling all day, it's awful. So, what are you accustomed to doing for intervals right now?
Well, I've been doing between 3,000 and 5,000, but I'm at 5,000 now.
Yeah, I wouldn't go more than that, but you're between 3 and 5, which makes it 4. Is a pretty good interval.
Okay.
And it's not that expensive to have your oil changed, but having engine issues later in the car's life can be really horrendous. I mean, thousands of dollars that we see because of infrequent maintenance. So that's what I would stick with if I were you.
Okay. May I ask you one other question?
Sure thing.
Okay. I have one tire that has a slow leak. I just keep filling it up with air. Then the other tire had a bubble on it. That tire, I bought a new one. But what's the bubble? What was the bubble?
More,
it
was
had
it,
a bubble.
Was the bubble on the sidewall of the tire?
It was on the sidewall of the tire, yep.
Yeah, that's almost always from an impact. That means like a pothole or a curb, a big rut or something in the road. Tires generally don't do that by themselves. It's after a slam through a hole or a rut that does that. It breaks a few of the cords in there, and that's why it bubbles out, because the cords are not holding that piece of the tire together.
So then you're more prone to a blowout?
Yeah, that tire can fail. So definitely if you have a bubble that sticks out of the tire, you definitely want to get that off the car, which you did.
Okay, well, I did.
Yeah.
I did. And then what about the slow leak? That won't blow out, will it? I just have to get it patched?
I would get it fixed if the tire is still in good shape. If it's poor, you might want to match the other new one that you just put on, and then you've got a nice matched set up front.
Okay.
Thanks, Barbara.
That's great. Thanks for your help. I appreciate it.
Appreciate the call. I know that we've had slow leaks on some of our tires. They turn out to be bad valve stems.
Yeah, valve stems can be the cause. Bead leaks between the rim and the tire are very common.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Now, some of the rims these days are not precisely made. Is that correct?
Well, it's more so from corrosion. The alloy wheel gets salt water in it from the winter,
yeah,
and it corrodes the aluminum, and when the corrosion occurs, it breaks that seal, and you get a slow leak.
Uh-huh. Let's go to Javon in Hudson. You're on.
Yes. I have a 2007 Hummer H3, and when I stop on a hill, it tends to roll back if I take myself.
Okay.
How steep of a hill are you talking? Even the slightest incline or fairly steep?
Yeah, just, I could say slightly inclined.
So does this vehicle, had it previously not done this?
No, it's been doing it since I had the car.
Okay.
I had the car 3 years now.
Yep. Yeah, well, that may be totally normal, because even with an automatic transmission, when you're sitting in gear waiting to go, and if you're on a hill, if the hill is steep enough, and that's a fairly heavy vehicle, it can push the vehicle backwards a little bit. So you may be okay. It's always a good idea to make sure that the transmission fluid is at the right level and it's clean and all that. But does it shift okay and drive okay otherwise?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, you may not have anything to worry about, but I think it'd be a good idea to... How many miles are on the vehicle?
120.
Yeah, yeah, it'd be a nice idea to make sure that transmission fluid's in good shape and it's been changed when it should have been and all that.
All right, that's my question. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Hey, thanks for calling. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Joe in Albany. Joe, you're up.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the show.
Sure.
I have a 2000 Ford Ranger, the six-cylinder 4x4, and I have trouble getting it into park and then shutting it off, and then when I go to restart, there's nothing unless I sort of jam the lever into park and then it'll connect, or if I go to neutral, of course, it'll start, but... I had somebody look at it, and they said they adjusted something, but it still seems to be doing it. Is that a major thing?
Probably what's happening there, Joe, is your linkage from the column down to the transmission. It's operated by a cable, and it's very possible that somewhere along the line there's some corrosion in there that's preventing that cable from pushing it completely into park. And the danger there is, I've seen this happen where the lever says you're in park, but you're not, and or it's barely in park, and then it slips out of park, and then the vehicle rolls away.
Yeah.
And of course,
yeah,
you really
I've had that experience.
And most
I've had that.
And so few people do this, but you really should be applying your parking brake before you put it in park. That's kind of the real procedure that's unbeknownst to a lot of people, but. In any case, I would have the shift cable looked at and the mechanism down at the transmission. I got a feeling it's going to be some corrosion and or there's something sloppy and that cable is not allowing that to go fully into park. And that's not going to be the worst thing in the world. I don't think you got a transmission problem.
So it's not a big deal?
I don't think so. I think it's an external situation with the linkage or that cable.
Great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks. He sounds relieved. You know, you bring up a great point about parking brakes, and it occurs to me that I haven't used a parking brake since I had a stick shift car.
Yes.
And that's 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Cars with automatic transmissions, of which probably 99% now are, it's a bit of a misconception in that if you look in your owner's manual, it'll tell you to come to a stop, apply the parking brake, then put it in park.
You're kidding.
But if you don't do that every single time, your parking brake mechanism in this part of the country will corrode and rust and stick. And then you'll use it one day and you'll say, oh, now my parking brake is stuck on. I'm dragging the car down the road, or there's smoke coming out of the brakes because the parking brake is stuck, or the pedal won't come back up.
Yeah.
But that's the deal. Yeah, and if you had a stick shift car, you just use it all the time.
Exactly.
Because you really kind of have to, you know?
And I got out as soon as I got rid of my last standard.
Yep, you stopped using
I got out of that habit.
Yes.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Mary in Canaan, New York. Mary, you're on.
Yeah, hi. So I have a 2000 Toyota Corolla. It's got like 180,000 miles on it. And every time I fill it up with gas, it doesn't start right away. And I have to wait a second, and then it starts.
Yeah.
So it happens every time.
Yep. That's not uncommon. Is your check engine light on?
No.
It isn't. Okay. Because a lot of times a check engine light will be on, and people, may have been on for a long time. And then you realize that when you fill the thing up with gas, it does this. But generally what happens here is when you refill the tank, when the liquid goes in, mm-hmm. the air that the liquid's displacing has to go out. And a lot of the pumps now have recapturing systems and all that, and in some states it just goes out into the atmosphere. But some of that gas vapor sometimes gets pushed back into the engine through the vent hoses and stuff. And if there's a vent valve stuck open, you'll get a lot of gas vapors built up. And when you start it, it kind of smothers the engine out temporarily until it cranks enough of it through, and then it starts. It's not harmful, but it's not uncommon to have a starting problem after filling your tank up. But to diagnose it and troubleshoot it could be a lot of work. Mm. That's why if the check engine light were on, it would help the mechanic go in the right direction.
Mm.
But I think it's a venting issue of some sort, and that's why you get that starting problem.
Mm. But do you think they need to have it checked out? Because, it runs fine.
If it doesn't really bother you, and your check engine light is not on, I don't think you really need to do anything with it.
Okay.
Unless
yeah,
you want to.
Because it starts every time.
Yeah, I don't think it's the beginning of a major problem, not by the sounds of it.
Well, you are reassuring today. What is going on with you?
Well, a lot of people call in panic mode because they think it's going to be nasty. So we're going to start with the subtle approach here. Everything's going to be easy.
I've been waiting for you to lower the boom like in previous. Hey, congratulations, Mary. It doesn't sound that bad.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for the call. David in Woodstock. David, you're on.
Hi, Gordon. With all due respect, I got to disagree with you on oil change frequency. Of course, if you're talking about an engine that uses non-synthetic oil, and sure, absolutely, 3,000, 5,000 miles is the right number. But I got a Mini Cooper 2005 with 309,000 miles on it, and up until about 50,000 miles ago, I was doing... There's a countdown timer on the Mini Cooper, and it was telling me to change my oil at 18,000 miles.
Wow.
I did that, and 50,000 miles ago, my mechanic started jumping up and down about high mileage, so I went to a 10,000-mile interval. And so at about 225,000 miles, he put a fiber optic scope in the cylinders, and he said he could still see the original factory hone marks. So
yeah.
I'm saying if you're using full synthetic and you're taking care of your car, you can go a lot longer than 3,000 to 5,000 on synthetic.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with the design of the engine and how the car's driven, and going back to the engine design. What year is your Mini Cooper?
2005, and I do a lot driving, you know, steady speed.
Yeah, that's
and,
what,
you know, nice, get the oil nice and hot and cook out all the you know, the water and stuff.
Yeah, see, the type of driving you are doing is a lot easier on everything. So you, a guy like you, can definitely go longer on an oil change. Variable valve timing is in most engines now, and I'm not sure. Mini Cooper, I think in 07, did some changes to the cylinder head and to the valve timing components. And we do work on some Mini Coopers, and I was talking with some guys at one of the bigger dealers, and they're saying that they are running into a lot of oil sludge issues on the newer ones from lack of oil changes because it's plugging up the variable valve timing components. Mm. And they're turning on check engine lights, and the valve timing is not doing what it should be, and the car is sluggish. So I would just caution anybody, you know, with a high-tech late-model engine to be very aware of oil change intervals. And I like to cut them in half unless the drive is perfect, and very few drives are perfect.
Now, does full synthetic make a big difference? Yeah. And is full synthetic a recommendation for Mini Coopers?
Yeah. Mini Cooper. BMW products all went to synthetic oil back in like 1998,
mm-hmm.
and Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, Audi, they're all using synthetic oil. And
I'm glad you told me that because I just ordered a new Mini Cooper yesterday, and I'll question the service manager at length about what he really recommends on oil changes.
Yeah, exactly. You should, because the opinion of the local dealer will vary from regions. You know, down south, it may not be such an issue because there's no cold weather, there's no winter, there's no warm-ups. People aren't idling their cars outside for 20 minutes, you know, waiting for it to warm up. So, and ask him about the variable valve timing. And I'm not sure on Euro 5, I'm sure it has it. I just don't know if they got more elaborate in the later years.
He's got 3,250 miles on it. I think he's doing something right.
He's called in before.
I don't think it's got variable valve timing. This is the original, the first generation Mini Cooper.
It may not. So definitely ask him about that because I think you'll hear a little different story.
Hey, David, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I know. Let's go to Chuck in Niskayuna. Hiya, Chuck.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I got a question for you. Right now I'm driving a 1999.5 Volkswagen Golf diesel, and it's got about 215,000 miles on it. It's never had a mechanical problem yet. Had a few electrical problems, but nothing else. What I'm wondering is, I think this car is probably reaching the end of its natural service life. What's an equivalent car that feels equally zippy at the low end RPM, but is still going to give you fantastic engine life at 50 miles per gallon that I could get now?
All right. Good question.
So the question was what a replacement car could be?
What kind of replacement car can I get now that's still diesel, going to give me good RPM and give me 50 miles per gallon?
Aside from another Volkswagen diesel, is that what you're asking?
That's certainly on the table.
Yeah. I mean, what's happened since your 99.5 is the diesel, Volkswagen diesels have become cleaner, quieter, smoother, more powerful, and probably better economy. They've gone to direct injection and, of course, computerized everything, but that's the way all cars are now.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine has a Jetta, clean diesel. It's a 2011, and he does a big commute weekly, and he is getting at some points over 50 miles per gallon with it, and the power is incredible. You should drive one of these newer ones. They're great.
So I feel a big difference, even just one or two generations.
Yeah, it's a different car now. I would definitely consider that new generation clean diesel.
Okay. Is there, I know BMW makes a diesel. Is that equivalent, or is that just a whole different species?
It probably is. I don't have any experience with them, and they just got back into sending diesels over to the U.S. But I'm sure it's along the same lines. They're probably on a similar page with their technology.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Chuck. So let's talk about diesel for a minute here. In the old days, the knock on diesel was,
you mean that really rattling, noisy engine?
No. I mean, perhaps that's one of them. But I always heard, tough to start in cold weather.
Sure, yes.
What were some of the drawbacks of diesel, and what were some of the pluses that have now been enhanced with what you call the new clean diesel?
Very good question, because the early days of diesel engines in cars, And in the U.S., that was Mercedes-Benz, and that was Volkswagen and Audi, and that was about it. BMW dabbled with them, and they didn't sell. Hard to start in cold weather.
Right.
Very noisy. Smoke out the tailpipe. Low power. What other negatives haven't we talked about?
Why would you want one then?
I was not a fan of those diesels. They got pretty good fuel mileage, and diesel was cheap back then.
Not so much anymore.
No, it's more than premium gasoline now.
Right.
So they've got to, they had to sharpen up their game, and now they are easier to start, almost as easy to start as a gasoline engine. Very few starting issues. Incredibly quiet, smoother, more power, and better economy. So everything has gotten way better.
Hmm. Diesel itself. Now, it's a less refined fuel
than the gasoline. Yep. When they refine the crude oil, you know, they're basically boiling it, and all these different levels come out, and the diesel is produced much lower on that refining tree than the gasoline. And then there's higher things that come out above that, but
why would it be more expensive now?
I think the big key word is tax.
Okay, there we go. Let's take a break, Zach, on that loaded topic. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. More with Gordon Fricke coming up.
Support comes from Smith College Museum of Art, presenting The Eye is a Door, landscape photographs by Ann Whiston Spurn, now on view, exhibition-related programs and more, smith.edu/artmuseum for details. Curtis Lumber, working to support their communities through their Pet Connection sponsorship and by providing professional consultations to homeowners and contractors. CurtisLumber.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, Massachusetts, since 1993 offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. And Old Songs Concerts, presenting Indian classical and folk musician Ustad Shafat Khan tomorrow at 8 p.m., oldsongs.org.
Hey, don't forget the lockbox. It is in operation at our website, wamc.org, wamc.org. The lockbox is something that we use to help shorten the fund drive. If you want to kick something, if you're going to put some money in during the drive and keep the station afloat, hey, put something in now. Basically, everything that goes in the lockbox counts at the first minute of the drive, which starts, I believe, June 2nd. So if you want, make a pledge. There's some stuff you can get. It's not really about that, but there's a pull-down menu with tons of stuff. We fill the lockbox. We shorten the drive. We're back to regular programming faster. WAMC.org. There's a great challenge. You maybe have heard Alan talk about that. We hit $325,000 in the lockbox by the start of the drive. We have about $150,000 to go over the next 3 weeks. If we hit the 325 mark, an anonymous benefactor, if you will put in $25,000. We're calling that person Mr. Big. So you want to make your pledge now. It makes a difference, and it's a little more than even you're giving. So 1-800-348-2551 is the number for this show. Let's go to Lisa in Albany. Lisa.
Yes, hi. I have a 2012 Honda Odyssey, and recently the malfunction light went off, so I took it to the dealer, and the report came back that one of the pistons was misfiring, and so they changed the rings and the spark plugs. And I was just curious as to why the car only has 27,000 miles.
Sure.
And just curious as to why would that happen. And I've never had that problem. I've had several Odysseys, the same model, and with over 100,000 miles, and I've never had that kind of problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just wondering if this is something that it's a manufacturer's problem or
yeah,
something that I'm doing?
It sounds to me like there was a defect, and that's what the warranty is designed to do, is to try to catch the bugs and take care of that stuff when the car is fairly young. Now, you say they did engine work. They did do some piston ring work?
Yes.
So the car was at the dealership for quite a while.
Well, it was there for 3 days.
Okay.
2 days, actually. Yeah. 2 days.
Very rare. Very rare to need any mechanical or physical engine work like that. And not knowing what they did to your vehicle, but... When the check engine light came on, did you notice that the vehicle was lower on power than usual? Was it kind of sputtering and not running right?
Yeah, you know, it's still, and even after they changed the spark plugs and the rings, it's still, when it hits 40 to 50 miles an hour, it rattles a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If they did piston and ring work, that's pretty serious engine work. You know, it's a pretty labor intensive job. And the telltale will be, of course, that check engine light. If it comes back on and it's another misfire or the same misfire, they're going to have to go back in there. The cause can be more than just one thing, but, you know, pay close attention to it. You know, you got plenty of warranty to go still. And if it's not quite running right, you know, bring it back to their attention.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lease. I've had it for 2 years. I was thinking of purchasing at the end of the lease, but now, you know, with all this work that it was done to the engine, one of my coworkers mentioned there, it's like having open heart surgery. It'll never be the same.
Well, not necessarily the case, but you don't expect to take Honda makes very good quality vehicles, and you just don't expect to take those engines apart. So maybe you might want to turn this one in and get another one instead of buying it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Lisa, thanks for a great question. We appreciate it, and good luck. Let's go to Fred in Wineskill. Fred.
Hi. This is another one of those oil change things, and I tuned in halfway through the show, so I didn't hear what you said earlier.
All right.
But I got a 2013 Honda Civic. I've got about 20. I put about 18,000 on it a year. That's the rate I drive. I always used to bring my car in about 3,000 miles for an oil change. These guys keep telling me, no, you don't have to bring it in now with the new oil in this car. You only need to bring it in like approximately, they say, 6 months or when you hit 15% of what it reads, you know,
yeah,
on the readout. So that comes out to about 9,000 miles. Now, when I came in the last time, I think. So after 6 months, I came in with 9,000. I had it only read out 50%, but I still had it changed.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, I wanted to have it changed at least in 6 months. Are you basically saying that just cut it in half to be safe?
That's what I'm recommending on a lot of vehicles.
I'm sorry, Gordon, but what about this 2013 Civic and what Honda's got going? Do I need to be as worried about it? It sounds like it's somewhat car specific, engine specific.
Well, Honda for that year car you have, Honda changed their oil specifications, and it's either semi synthetic or full synthetic. Originally, the Honda oil was a blend, but they also have a full synthetic version of that the dealerships use, and it is capable of going longer, for sure. And Honda's got that system in there that takes into account start, stops, and cruises and all that. And that's why you get this percentage. So there's no set exact interval.
So it doesn't just go by miles.
No.
That's great.
It's doing calculations.
I do a lot of highway driving.
Yeah, so. That's why your percentage is taking so long to decline, because you're doing such good, easy driving. Is this a car that you are going to keep, you know, a long, long time? Or
I mean, typically I keep my cars not super long, 8 years, you know.
Yeah, yeah. My recommendation would be, and maybe I'm getting a little old school, but we see the sludge and the engine issues when the cars are older from the old oil. You know, maybe cutting it in half is a, maybe a little bit too drastic for this, but waiting till that thing hits zero and you're at, let's say you're at 11 months and you've gone 13,000 miles,
I mean,
it's too much.
I'll do 6 months or,
That's what I would do. I think I'd go 6 months no matter what and then just change
it. Could I have hurt the engine so far? It's only got like 20,000.
I don't think so.
And I got good mileage last. I got 40 miles per gallon coming down from Glens Falls a couple days ago.
What's your percentage reading right now?
Well, I just had it changed.
Oh, you just had it done.
Okay. So when I had it changed about a month ago, and it was changed in like October, November before that, it was still at 50% at like 6 months.
Did you ever look at it, pull the dipstick out and look at the oil?
Yeah.
Doesn't
look all black or anything.
No, and is it still okay level-wise?
It's got like an amber color in it, and it's still a good level, yeah.
Well, you know, those are very well-built, very efficient engines. So
6 months anyway.
Yes, I wouldn't go any more than that.
No, I wouldn't either.
All right, Fred, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551. Is there a sensor? You know, most cars, you get 3,000 miles, a little light goes on, time for your oil change. Is there, and then this car that Fred had takes into account the starts and stuff.
Yeah.
But is there a sensor in any high-end car that actually just sort of does a survey of the oil itself and says, well, it's murky now and it's not looking good?
Not yet, Ray, but you never know. There may be because in heavy trucks, train locomotive, industrial engines, oil gets sent out and gets sampled, or samples of oil go out and gets identified at a lab for contamination and breakdown. And like on a locomotive, the freight trains, they never change the oil in those things.
Yeah.
They change filters, they add oil, and they test it constantly. And they put in additives and stuff. So there may be a time when there is a sensor in the crankcase saying, the chemistry in your oil is decreased to the point where you should get it changed.
Well, that would probably cost a little bit.
You never know, though. With technology, you'll probably see that.
All right. We're predicting the future here on Vox Pop. David in Springfield. David, you're on.
I don't need all this.
Hello, you're
Hi.
On.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hello.
Yes, I've got a problem with a brand-new Toyota Tundra that I just purchased in November with the cruise control. And my problem is that when I'm driving down the highway and towing a boat, if the truck can't maintain at least 10 miles an hour faster than, maintain the speed, if it goes below 10 miles an hour, the whole system shuts down, and it also will never jump into high gear.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you might have any. And I've been back to the dealer a bunch of times, and they just look at me like, well, you know, that's a strange problem. We don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, you don't know what to do. It's a $30,000 truck.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The cruise control is, if it can't keep up, if you're going up too much of a hill with too much of a load, I think it's got programming in it that says something's wrong. We can't keep up with this, and that's why it shuts down. Does your truck have a tow haul mode on your shifter for when you're towing? Is there a button that you press for towing?
Tow package.
Yeah, but is there on your shift lever or on your dash, is there a tow mode?
No.
There isn't. Okay, because a lot of U.S. trucks have a tow haul mode. And that
low gear?
Well, yeah, it prevents you from, I think it may keep it going out of overdrive or the shift points are different because it knows you're carrying a big load. I think what I would do, David, at this point is in your owner's manual, call Toyota. They've got an 800 number in there for customer assistance, and they will definitely be able to answer that question one way or the other.
Yeah, because let me tell you, it is really frustrating. I mean, it won't jump down into the high gear, but if you're driving normally and you're going up a hill and you have your foot down on the pedal, as you move it obviously farther down, it jumps into a lower gear and then it keeps up fine.
Exactly.
So the engine is more than powerful enough to do what it needs to do.
But it won't do it when it's in cruise control is what you're saying.
Oh, man, it's just so frustrating. Second question for you.
Quickly.
Now, this thing gets 16 miles a gallon normal, but it only gets 8 when I'm towing a small boat. Do you have any idea why it would be that bad?
How heavy is the boat? Do you know?
About 1,200 pounds.
1,200? That is light. That is a light load. Is it big? Is it dragging through the wind?
No, it's just like an 18-foot regular boat.
Yeah.
Even if I tow a flatbed trailer that has no drag, it gets the same mileage. It's horrible.
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of people complain about Tundras and Nissan Titans for getting really, really bad gas mileage. And I don't have the answer. I don't know why. I mean, they're heavy and they're big, but some of their U.S. counterparts in the truck department are getting much better fuel economy than that. It'd be another good question to ask Toyota, you know, the company, not the dealership.
Yeah, well, I will definitely do that. Thank you for your advice.
You're welcome,
David. Well, of course, from the legal department here, that's all anecdotal information from Gordon, and
correct,
he's unverified, and so the lawsuits can stop before they start. Kyle and Colony. Kyle, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have an 04 Acura TSX. It's got about 92,000 miles on it, and I had it into the shop about a month ago for just the questions for my brakes, and I was told that I have a crack in my steering rack and that the power steering fluid was really low. So I asked a buddy of mine who's got a good mechanical background about it, and he said that I can probably avoid replacing it for the time being as long as I keep the fluid level topped off. So I went to the store, got some power steering fluid, filled it up, and I've driven about 2,000 miles, and it hasn't moved an inch. So I'm just wondering, you know, should I be concerned that there actually is a crack in there? What would have led to the level getting so low?
It's not uncommon for steering racks to leak, and I don't know if they really identified a crack in it or if they saw that it was just seeping from somewhere, from the seals. And you said this was an Acura?
Yeah, that's correct. It's
okay.
A TSX.
Yep. It does take a special power steering fluid. Did they give you the stuff for that car?
I got like a Pennzoil, but it was like a Japanese-specific Pennzoil,
okay.
I
yep.
think.
Yeah, that's fine. As long as it was designed for that car, because Honda had their own fluid for a long time, and you don't want to intermix and put the wrong stuff in.
Okay.
It's possible that it took years for that level to go that low, and you just topped it back up.
And you'll be fine.
And it might take years again. So I think you're okay just keeping an eye on it.
If that's the case, then I had it at the dealership probably 2 months before taking it to this independent shop. Shouldn't that be like a standard thing that they check?
The level of the power steering fluid?
Yeah.
Yeah, if they're doing a maintenance on the car, yes, they should check it for sure.
Okay. Okay, and if it turns out that I do end up having to replace it, I've looked, because I was told it's going to be, you know, probably upwards of $1,000.
Yeah.
So I did a little searching around online. I found some on eBay that are reconditioned for, you know, like $300. Would you, you know, tell somebody to stay away from those?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. You can't change this yourself. It's a pretty nasty
job. Rack?
Yeah, yeah. And I think Ray's got rack and
we had that happen
yeah.
in a van with only 30,000 miles,
yeah.
and it was not cheap.
No, it's pretty, there's a fair amount of labor involved. The vehicle needs to be aligned afterwards. So I think what I would do is I would want to use a part that the repair shop is accustomed to using and has a good warranty and backing behind it. Because if you buy one from somebody on eBay and it gets put in and something fails, I doubt you're going to get much assistance
yeah.
for that failed part. So I'd beware of mail order because your shop's going to want to be comfortable with companies they deal with that'll support them if you had a part failure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you may
not
be faced with this. You may go a long time and not have to replace it.
Well, that's good news. All right, Kevin in New Paltz, I'm sorry to say you have about 25 seconds.
Yeah, I'm calling about the recommended oil change. I have a Honda Accord 2011, and it's recommended that you do it at 5,000-mile interval. I use a synthetic blend. And what's the difference between a synthetic blend and just a synthetic?
Yeah, a full synthetic has more additives and more man-made materials or liquids in there than the blend. The blend is more base oil and less additives, and the synthetic is less base oil and more additives.
But
so,
a full synthetic really isn't a full synthetic.
No, it isn't. It's not completely non-petroleum, but it's got more things in it to make it a synthetic and make it a little bit longer lasting.
Okay, and a few seconds left here. You said 5,000 miles?
Kevin?
Yeah, 5,000 miles. Do you recommend that, or should I cut that in half?
Actually, 5,000 on a good quality synthetic oil under decent conditions is okay nowadays. So I think you're okay.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Gordon Fricke, thanks a lot for being here. Good job.
You're welcome. Boy, they hammered us today.
They sure did, and that's what we like best. And thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Support comes from Edward Garbosik, Certified Financial Planner, Havokin Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement, HavokinWealthStrategies.com. East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com for information. Unison Arts, New Paltz, presenting Freedom Songs, an evening of music from the civil rights era with Jeremy Mage, Tumar Kali, and Jason Charles Walker, May 17th at 8, unison.org. And the Daily Hampshire Gazette, 225 years of providing news and information for Hampshire County, GazetteNet.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Our phones were answered by Anonymous Sandy. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Food Friday tomorrow. I'm taking the day off. Katie Britton will be in. Have a great day. We'll see you next week.